Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hello, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And we're very pleased to have Drew Winstall join us this week. Welcome, Drew.
Thanks, Will. Carlton, how are you gentlemen doing?
Doing well. Happy to be doing a podcast. It's always a good morning when that's happening. So, as always,
thanks for having me on.
No, thanks
for
coming.
Yeah, so I think I first met you in person at DjangoCon US this past fall, where you were one of the program chairs, and we were able to do bike rides every morning, which Carlton and I got in the habit of doing at the last one, so that was lovely. But maybe before we get into all that, what's your quick background, and then we're a lot of areas we want to cover about Django and other things.
Definitely. Well, I got started, usual like nerdy grade school kid, had Apple IIe's in the computer lab, then Macs, and learned some Apple Basic along the way. Got my first desktop computer at home in the mid-90s, did a bunch of QBasic and, you know, fun stuff like that on there. Learned some, got a book on C or C++ back when I was in middle school. Didn't really take too much at that point. Then in college, I majored in electrical and wireless engineering at Auburn University. So it wasn't a CS major as such, but a lot of CS adjacent stuff. Had classes in C, x86 assembly, C++. All the professors assumed we knew MATLAB. None of us did. You know how that goes.
You can learn that if you can do diodes, you can do MATLAB. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's all just Boolean logic, right?
It's more hardcore than computer science. Like, if someone's like an EE or, you know, at MIT, like EECS or something, you know, that's like, ooh, like that's kind of the pinnacle. It's like, oh, computer science. Well, you don't really know how these binary gates work, do you? At least, you know.
Spoiler alert, neither do we.
You have classes on it, though.
Yeah, details, you do. But so while I was there at Auburn, actually one of the first people I met there was Lacey Williams-Henschel, who chaired DjangoCon US back in 2017 at Spokane. And she and I were friends through all the Honors College stuff there. And weird small world thing, you had a college of 25,000 people. She actually knew my wife back then for doing all the English major stuff together, because they were both English majors. And then, Lacey and I reconnected on Twitter back in the early 2010s, started chatting through there. And then when I was working at an IoT shop here in Huntsville, Alabama, where I'm based, it's a Python shop where they actually run a little embedded chip that runs Python on the device itself, a subset, not quite MicroPython, but a similar idea to it. And we're looking for something to run on the back end that ran Python, set up a little REST API. And one of the guys suggested Django. And so set up a DRF backend for that. The front end ran AngularJS back in the day and a leaflet to do a little mapping thing. Mm-hmm. And that's where I got started with it. Shortly thereafter, that project got shut down and I got laid off while my wife was pregnant, appropriately enough.
Right, yeah, good
so
timing.
So quickly found a job. Oh, totally. Quickly found a job with actually one of the guys in my homebrew class, or not homebrew class, homebrew club, rather. And
not so the software, though.
That's actually different.
You mean actual homebrew there, don't you?
Yes, homebrew
so
beer. Right,
okay, so we're going to put that on the side.
Actual
we'll come
beer,
back
yes.
to that in a moment. You finish this and then we'll come back to
the beer, yes, absolutely. Yes, because there's actually a Django thing related to beer as well. We'll come back to.
Brilliant.
So, yes. So, yeah. All right. So, went to the little shop that is remote lighting management, and they had a homegrown lamp stack. It's very clearly written by a computer science by an electrical engineer, not a computer science person. I took that. I rewrote the stack and made a DRF backend, DRF gateway to the remote devices, and the other developer wrote a React frontend for it. And so that was a complete ground-up rewrite, very nice. And in the process of that, I gave a talk at DjangoCon US 2018 talking about the pitfalls I had on that. And I think we're going to link to that talk in the show notes so you can see some of that.
Yeah, I was just looking at that talk again last night.
Nice, thanks. A couple years later, hopped over to different jobs, and now I'm at the Noun Project, which is based in Los Angeles, where we work with a Django stack with a GraphQL API and a React frontend for most of our stuff. And the Enterprise API, through historical accident, runs on Flask and SQL Alchemy.
And that, can you give a sense of the scale? Because I think like quite a bit of scale, especially with the API that you all deal with.
Yeah, I mean, we've got, I think last count, about 5.5 million, give or take, icons that we serve up. A few thousand requests per minute, you know, so it's not like web scale or anything like that, but it's still a pretty solid load on there.
And you can cash it, right? You can cash most of that, right? It doesn't change too often, or am
I? We do a lot of caching with it to help out, of course. Use Elasticsearch to handle a lot of the database that would be database load for the searching itself, because, you know, it's MySQL as the back end database, and so if you look at it the wrong way, things go south with it.
We just need to be like, hey, Django, Postgres, you know, built in. Let's just drop Elasticsearch, right? Save some money, ground up, rewrite.
Yeah, go full text.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. What could go wrong? I've been through one ground up rewrite. What's another one?
That's right. That's right.
Just burn it to the ground and start again.
Why fix the niggling little things when you can just burn it all down? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, and the process of going to DjangoCon US at 17 in Spokane, where I first saw Lacey again for the first time, that was a great time. Got to meet a whole bunch of people. That was where the venue had some trouble getting people into their rooms. And so I was sitting out in the lobby and met people like Katie McLaughlin, Russell Keith McGee, just a whole bunch of people sitting out in the hallway. And just, you know, like these people who were like, oh, hey, I've seen your name and things, but I have no idea who you are. And now, oh, hey, you're just cool people. And it was a lot of fun. Got to meet some awesome people. And then I talked in 18, and then Jessica Deaton, aka Deets, recruited me to be an organizer for 2019. And I was like, hey, where can I help out? And I got put as in the Opportunity Grants group, took over as chair there, ran that. Then 2020, the pandemic hit.
Yes.
And so that got canceled. 2021 was pretty much just the board running the show for the little online conference. And so I ran program for that. 2022 came back to the in-person conference, and back in San Diego one more time. It was a lot of fun. We had a bit of a skeleton crew running it, so I was running program, opportunity grants, and also effectively co-chair of the conference.
So that explains why you were quite like busy moving around the conference there.
Very much so, yes.
Yeah. Well, it is one of these things that I hope, you know, we can highlight in this episode. We have talking with Jeff Triplett in the past is that, you know, you show up to a DjangoCon mm-hmm. event, and maybe unlike other ones, it's not professional organizers. It's volunteers.
It's all volunteers.
And
yeah,
they're so busy, you may not even get to see them because they're so busy during that. They're not just hanging out in the hallway because they can't. But it's,
right.
You know, that's why we have these events. And especially when I was on the board the past 3 years, sort of see the inside of how much, you know, what a lift it is on the volunteers who make DjangoCon US and DjangoCon Europe happen. It's, you know, it's an incredible service to the community. So I hope people are aware of it.
Oh, totally.
And it sort of takes maybe the second conference when you're like, oh, start to have a sense of things. So the first conference, everything is so new and doesn't really hit in.
Right. And so, and as you both saw, I did the call for volunteers during the opening remarks on that Tuesday of the conference. Got a great response from that. We had a bunch of people sign up. And so right now, I think we had our first weekly organizer meetup last week, and had somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25 people show up for that.
Oh,
so already
great.
A huge improvement.
Right. And that's
yeah. And
I was going to say that's really good. It's good not just for this year, but that's hopefully that leaves a sustainable base, because what you don't
hopefully.
Want is the same three heroes
Precisely.
Running the whole thing every year. Because
right, exactly. And Jeff is trying to take more of an advisory role this year, and we're hoping that he can actually do that and not be involved in the nitty gritty of everything again like he was last year.
We'll see if that goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So for this year's conference, which will be in Raleigh-Durham, can you talk a bit about the opportunity grants? Because that's something that I don't know if everyone's aware of, that, you know, because it is expensive to go if your company doesn't help you pay. But can you talk a little about how those work?
Sure. So what happens is this will actually be going live likely this week. Both the call for proposals and the opportunity grants will open up. And so what we're going to do, what happens is there's a form that gets pushed out on the speaking page and over social media and everything. It's just a Google form you fill out, talk about who you are, what excites you about DjangoCon, is this your first time coming, are you speaking at DjangoCon, just some basic questions to try and get a feel for why you want to come to DjangoCon, why you should get money. And then we'll give you up to, you know, a little bit of money, somewhere up to, I think it depends on your case, whether you're traveling from the US or overseas, there's a travel budget maximum. Help out with airfare, hotel, food costs, so that, and visa fees if you're coming from overseas, to help out with help alleviate the cost of coming to DjangoCon, because it is a big outlay, especially if, given, you know, current fuel prices, things are going to be expensive to fly there. I think just looking at Google Flights yesterday, it looks like my possible flight to Durham from Alabama is going to be more than my flight to San Diego was last year.
Wow. Huh. Well, it yeah. It's also the case, I mean, just with on airline flights that, you know, if you're on one of these, like, because I'm in Boston, it's like way cheaper to fly all the way across the country than anywhere, you know, in between, just because of like popular right. routes. But yeah. Anyways, mm-hmm. people should, and historically, if you propose a talk and it's accepted, you also, you don't have to pay for the conference. And then there's also, if you need a chance for opportunity grants. So a plug to put in for a talk.
And separate, right. And then separate from that also is we have a $500 travel reimbursement that all speakers are eligible for, even if they don't apply for opportunity grants. So if you're, so if you know, your company's paying for part of it, you can use the $500 to cover the gap and then you're good to go. Or if you need more than that, you can apply for the opportunity grant on top of the $500. And so, yes, please submit talks.
Please submit talks.
All right, good. We'll have links to all that. And yeah, it'll be on the usual channels and the Django newsletter. If anyone listening isn't already subscribed, it'll be on there. Great.
Hang on, but this is in the autumn, right? Because I've literally just done my submission for DjangoCon Europe. So I'm a bit like, I've got to come up with another one already. Right. When's the call for paper? When's the call for proposal? When's it going to shut? Because that's the key date. Like,
It's supposed to start this week. Basically, we just have a few HTML related things to finish up on the page itself. And then once that's done, it'll go live and it'll run through May 15th.
May. Okay. So there's a little bit of time left to, you know.
Correct. It's not urgent, but it's not like you have 3 weeks to submit your talk. You have time.
Yeah, good.
So DEFNA, the Django Events Foundation of North America, you're the vice president of that. Could you talk about, I mean, that runs the Django Cons, but that also is its own thing. Could you briefly just talk about how DEFNA works?
Yeah, so back in the 2010s, the group of people, Craig Bruce, Jeff Triplett, and a few people others whose name I do not remember off the top of my head, all got together and realized that if we need DjangoCon to be sustainable, we need a nonprofit to run it and help maintain the year-to-year knowledge of how to run a DjangoCon. And so DEFNA and the DSF signed a contract where DEFNA runs DjangoCon US. So each year we submit, you know, here's when we're trying to do DjangoCon. The DSF approves the date, make sure there's no major conflicts with other DjangoCons or religious holidays or things like that. And so then we get together we run everything from gets the call for proposals, venue solicitations, website design solicitations, and then maintain a documentation of how to run DjangoCon year in, year out. So that way we can, as we cycle through volunteers, we can help maintain some continuity and get a solid base under it, and then hopefully get a more sustainable base as the years go on.
I think that's the fundamental great idea about DEFNA. I think we need something similar in for DjangoCon Europe, because it's run very well for years and years and years. But there's times where it's been like, hang on, who's going to run it next? And then that bit right. about passing on the knowledge, codifying the knowledge and passing it on, I just think that's monstrously valuable and, you know, something that...
Right. I know from a legal perspective, it's a little bit harder in the EU just because you have different national bodies doing the governance, but there should be a way to make it work.
I think we could set up something in, I don't know, Estonia and... You know.
You're giving me like PTSD here. We spent so much. We on the board spent so much time on this during.
Yes, I'm sure
during COVID and this last. So I wish you were right, Carlton, about the legal aspect. I wish can we get under the umbrella of EuroPython or another thing? But we haven't figured out a solution in Python. Like the PSF, we always ask them for help. I mean, they're having a transition in leadership. There isn't an easy solution that we're aware of on the legal side. And then the separate bit that DEFNA, because it's been running and runs well, has a little leftover money. Like it donates a huge amount back to Django itself, but it does have some reserve funds. So, for example, it was able to absorb the cost during COVID of having to eat some bills. There is no equivalent in DjangoCon Europe. So yeah. then it...
Right, or Australia, to my knowledge.
Or Australia when it was running. So then it falls on the board. So anyways, yes, I 1,000% agree. If there's a way that we're missing to have a DEFNA for Europe, both legally and then both in a way to run it so that there's some reserve cash to cover things that come up.
I think...
Yeah, I don't want to go on about board stuff, but yeah, that's a big concern.
No, but I think it's
right.
It's a legitimate topic for the website, right? Is that like if you if you're going to hire an event, you've got to put down an event, a venue. You've got to put down thousands and thousands and thousands.
Five figures.
Yeah.
Solid five figures.
Right?
Yeah.
And that can't come out of someone's pocket.
Even higher than that, depending on the venue.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit less in Europe sometimes, but yeah.
Yeah, we've got a... And this year was a little bit different because the hotel and the venue itself are separate entities, so we don't have the room trade for event space that we had in previous years, where you just have to, you know, we actually have to do a separate big chunk of money up front to cover the venue cost as well, separate from the food and beverage minimum.
Right.
So that, you know, that's, you know, what is it, eight months out? I can't do math. 8 months out, and we're forking over something like $50,000 for it.
And that's but that's too much for an individual to put on their own credit card or to, you know, it's got to,
precisely.
There has to be a body to back that up.
I mean, it's, you know, a sizable amount of the DSF's like
reserve,
which is not that much.
Yeah.
You know, no. I think when I stepped down, it was something like 200,000 total, which is about a year's run rate. So, anyways, yeah, shout out to Jeff Triplett for being the lead on all that. I know, along with other DefNet people, but Jeff spent a lot of time on that. So,
but just one more point here. Like, I think there's two aspects to it. One is the legal body. Like, can we do that in Europe? I don't know. You've obviously looked into it. It's difficult. But that the second bit is that kind of codifying the knowledge aspect. We don't need a legal body to do that. I think that's something that. I don't know, where is the run book for DjangoCon Europe? I think that's something that we could work on.
I think COVID really hurt us. And then we had the organizers in Porto who did a fantastic job.
Yes.
Getting out of the habit of having it be in a different location each time meant that transfer of knowledge got lost a little bit. So I know when we had, so there are people still who kind of remember from 5-6 years ago and have been called upon to help with the organizers this year, but it's a lot. And I think it's also it's more complicated because it's not the same country, right? So
yeah.
some of the things that are if anyone wants to set up a DefNet Europe, we could use it.
Yeah, I mean, like this year it's in Britain. Absolutely. Which is, you know, a whole separate thing.
Not even Europe, I know, right? Yeah, exactly.
No, that doesn't count. Yeah.
All right, anyway, homebrew, Drew. You make homebrew?
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us
I
about
do.
That.
Yes, I got in. Sure thing. I got into homebrewing back in 2010 or 11, back when I first moved here to Alabama, moved back to Alabama after graduating college, and the beer scene was just very much in its infancy around here. There was one brewery who, they had some, shall we say, questionable sanitation practices, so batches tended to be infected, which was not great.
It is really hard. It is very easy to, yeah.
Oh, yeah. No question. And then they closed. A couple of the breweries popped up, but things were just getting started. And most of the breweries that have spawned up since then, we have 10 now, I think, have all come from our, two of them have come from our homebrew club as going professional.
Okay, wow.
Which is kind of nice. It's called the club is called the Rocket City Brewers. Rocket City because Huntsville has NASA Marshall Space Center and, you know, Wernher von Braun and all of that. So lots of space influence around here.
And what's the brew of choice? Because, like, so I'm from Vermont. And, you know, so, you know, East Coast style IPAs, you know, so the West Coast had these strong IPAs and now there's a New England IPA and, like, but it's warmer where you are, so it may not want like an 8% thing, but I don't know what's popular down your way.
A little bit of course, like everywhere else these days, IPA dominates everything. My personal choice is, like, when I'm brewing, if I'm just brewing something for me, is about a 6 to 6.5% West Coast IPA. Nothing too heavy, but still enough that you can enjoy some good, like, strong, like, piney, sometimes citrusy hops in there.
Well, they make now, they make actually some really, really quite good non-alcoholic beers, which is great. But also,
yes, definitely.
A lot of I've seen a bunch of these really good double IPA makers around here are making, you know, like 4 or 5% versions. Cause, like, me personally, like, I'm just too old. Like, I can't have more than like if I have 2 to 8%, I'm just wrecked.
Oh, yeah, I'm done. Yeah.
So, anyways, there's starting to be, you know, it's like, you know, gradually softening up the beer. You know, I was talking to someone the other day about some video game, and all these games now have like casual mode. So there's like, oh, like hard mode. And then there's literally just like, you know what? Like, I don't care if it's a shooting game or just an adventure game. I just want to like chill and be like only moderately challenged. And I love that like, so all these games I play now have like a casual, like don't die. Because like, you know, anyway, so I'm embracing getting older, right, Carlton?
I'm loving this. I'm laughing because I'm just like, we've just turned into old men now. It's like, yeah, I have.
No, but we're not. We're not
so much.
But I'm not upset. I'm not upset about it. Like, I'm happy about it.
Oh no!
You just like all these things that you had time to worry and energy about before. You're just like, well, that's gone. So you know. Anyway, sorry.
I had one question about the home brewing. Was like, I have this imagination of like Homer Simpson with a still that sort of in the basement that explodes as he's trying to. But that's a different kind of brewing, right?
It's a bathtub. It's a bathtub, Carl.
Right. Okay. It's not like this.
No, that's you're thinking of distillation there, where you actually have to do the
that's the harder stuff.
The brewing step, and then they get to distill it into a whiskey after that, which is a lot more effort. Yes.
You don't do that.
Yeah, so my setup is a big metal tank for doing the actual boil process. You start with a couple of actually 10 quarts, that's what, 38 liters, coolers that do what's called the mash, where you take your crushed up grains, barley, roasted to various temperatures and things like that to give the flavor and color. Steep the hot water in there for an hour. Then you rinse it with more hot water to flush all the rest of the sugars out. That goes into a boil kettle. Where boil it for an hour, adding in hops as you go along to decide to make it how much bitter or how much hoppy flavor you want, depending on how long the hops are in the boil. Longer boil means more bitterness, but less flavor, and vice versa. Then cool it down, add the yeast, put it into a fermentation vessel, which can either be like a glass carboy, so you know, a glass tank that's about. I don't know why I'm making hand motions right now. A podcast is a visual medium.
He's going about screen height there, folks.
Yeah, exactly. It's about screen height. Yeah. A 5-gallon glass jug or a plastic bucket that you let that ferment for a couple of weeks. Then you can either bottle it or keg it and let it carbonate and drink it.
Okay. So you're a couple of weeks out when you start. So you've got a schedule.
So it's about 4 weeks usually from
starting
to drinking. Yeah.
Okay. Brilliant.
You can be faster if you hire things up, or it can be longer depending if it's a higher gravity batch.
And then premium stuff, it doesn't last for forever either. You know, there's like, what's your sort of time frame? Like, I've gotten some pretty good like micro beers up in Vermont, and you know, if you don't drink them within like 2 weeks, they really fall off.
Yeah. Especially the New England IPAs are very much about, they lose their character super fast. So that's one of the things that makes those, you know, they're not super fresh, they'll fade within, and they're not stored well, they'll fade within a couple of weeks easily. Your less hoppy stuff and higher alcohol stuff, like your Imperial Stouts, your Imperial Porters, those you can age for years if they're actually prepared right, which you purge all the oxygen out of them before you bottle or can them. I mean, I've got some beers in my fridge from 2015 that are still drinking very pretty.
Oh, well, that's good going. Mostly because you've managed to hold off that long.
Yeah, the self-restraint.
Well, they're also like 14-15% beers in wine bottle sizes. I couldn't do that by myself.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough.
Well, there is there's this, maybe I'll put in the notes if anyone cares. There's a really interesting book that came out last year called Drunk, about history of alcohol and like why people have been doing this for forever. And one of the interesting points was that the distillation is quite new. It used to be back in the day, because like back in the day, everyone just drank beer because you couldn't drink the water. So they were all kind of drunk all the time. You know, that's why caffeine helped, because then they weren't drunk. But it was only 2-3%. Mm-hmm. So it was
right, very low gravity.
You kind of couldn't get drunk, that like drunk. But now with distillation, you know, you can get drunk super fast. And it's almost like humans haven't culturally or are biologically caught up with that. So anyways, I thought that was interesting, but. That's probably enough about alcohol. We should also mention one of the great things about Django Cons is there's absolutely no pressure around drinking, bars. All the events are
none whatsoever.
Explicitly not directly about that, because that can be a thing at tech conferences. And so that's one of the things I like about Django Cons.
Yeah. And if people want to organize something to go to a place and grab some beers or whatever afterwards, you're more than welcome to do so. We have Slack channels for outings in our attendee Slack where you can say, hey, I want to go get food, or I want to go get ice cream or coffee or whatever. And people just kind of self-organize into groups. Tim Schilling, one of our new board members this year on DEFNA, he gave a tutorial last year. and just basically stood outside the entrance to the hotel and just waited for people to start forming groups and found a different group each night and had a grand old time meeting new people and trying different things. And that's a really great way to meet new people, which actually leads into how I got into Noun Project, because at DjangoCon US 2019 back in San Diego, I was getting a group together to go to one of the many breweries that San Diego has on hand. And Joseph Cokerhens, who was the CTO at the time, actually drove down from at Los Angeles. And so he's like, I've got a car, I can drive a few people. And so we drove over to North Park, the area which has a bunch of breweries over there, went to a couple of those, and had some great food, great beers together. And then a few months later, February 2020, I was looking for a new job. And Jeff Triplett actually reconnected me with Joseph. And he's like, oh, hey, I remember you. Interviewed and then landed the job and was supposed to fly to Los Angeles to meet the new team in March of 2020.
Right.
Right. Yeah. But then it was
womp not. Womp.
Yeah.
But now here I am almost 3 years later and still a great place.
Yeah. That's wonderful. So I don't know how much can we or do you want to talk about the Noun Project, since that is your day job and there's some Django in there?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah, we've got a small team. There are two back-end engineers, myself and one other person, and three front engineers right now with the hiring, trying to hire a fourth one. Trying to implement new features right now. We're working on user-generated photo uploads so they can, because we sell both icons and stock photos. And so trying to expand our photo library a bit more. And so that way we can, you know, start selling subscriptions to the photos and they can, you know, not just buy one-off photos, but actually get like, hey, here's X amount of money for X photos per month type of thing to help increase our steady subscriber base and bring in more revenues. The back end, we have an enterprise API that big name customers like Adobe use to fetch lots of icons at a time that will help us with them that they use to... offer to their own customers, like some editing type things. I'm not entirely sure what their use cases are for it, but like logo builders, various design and print services, they'll do their queries on their end and actually search our icon library for the icons. And then they can use a block list to deny certain words that they or deny explicit icons if things that they don't want those, for example. And so that gives them a fancy way to basically put our stuff forward and use it for things like, say, building this t-shirt that I'm wearing, which has a dumpster fire icon on it. This is one that we actually sold in our company store last year.
I was looking at that. I was thinking that was a toaster. I was like, you've overcooked your toast there.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I was thinking a toaster too, but now
yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Well,
yep.
Well, so I was just digress all over the place. So merch. So Django has a merchandise store, which is up and does have sales. I always see, like, Carlton was wearing his GitHub hoodie earlier. Marius has one, some people have one. I would love to figure out how we Django have like a really nice hoodie that, like, we go to a Django con and people are wearing Django stuff. Like, if a listener
yes,
knows
totally.
I know this is something companies can do, but it's something that we don't want just printed. We don't want what we have now, where we have like I forget which service we use, but Threadless is great.
And the t-shirts are high quality. Like I got the if
yeah,
you
yeah,
get
no,
the,
we have
oh yeah,
they're quite good. I bought a few of them and they last a long time. They don't lose their shape. So I do recommend them. But
yeah, and that's because I think I picked the the quality option for the t-shirts.
Well done.
But there's probably a level up just in terms of design and stuff that we could do on a sweatshirt. So if anyone knows, I would love to go to DjangoCon and see a little more Django stuff as opposed to other things.
One thing we've got to think about as well, I mean, just from someone who lives in Europe's point of view, is like getting them made up in Europe as well as made up in the States, because shipping them into Europe,
right,
it becomes like you pay the external tariff, you pay the rest. Whereas if we can get them produced here, it's a lot cheaper to your door.
Yeah, I would totally buy a full zip hoodie.
I want enamel pins, to be honest. Enamel pins and socks. I want socks. Socks are my favorite.
Ooh.
Do we want elbow pads?
Yeah, leather elbow pads with Django on. We could have that.
Yeah.
Oh, why not?
Socks would be good. Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, one of the questions I wanted to ask you or just about Noun Project is, right, with all the open AI stuff, how does that change, or what's the internal discussion around, images and all these things happening?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the things we try to go for, like, you know, very more artistic, like opinionated artistic stuff, which the AIs at this point, thankfully, can't really replicate so much. So even if they were trying to do it, it's a different plane of competition, so to speak. But I mean, yeah, obviously we're watching the space very closely, especially I think Getty's suing Stable Diffusion over copyright infringement with, because, you know, they can, that Stable Diffusion can generate the Getty image wordmark pretty well, because you can tell that was very much used in his training data, for example. And there's a whole litany of questions regarding like diversity, inclusion within the training sets. Is it a representative sample of the population at large? Are there biases in there? Because I mean, at the end of the day, the algorithm puts out the biases that you put into it, and so that, you know, as a company that focuses heavily on DEI, that's something that we just, you know, can't do per se, because we need that human touch to it.
Right. There's that whole, do you guys hear about the Sydney before they shut it down? The like personality within OpenAI that was, speaking of what it's trained on, is like trained on the internet. It was like super creepy and manipulative.
That's happened before too. I mean, remember Microsoft Tay from a few years ago?
Yeah, right. And it's like all these things too. Like all these things are, you know, racist too, because, like, you know, there's a lot of racist things out there. And, you know, it's like, no wonder these tools are trained that way, because look what's going into them. But anyways,
exactly.
I've got a gripe. While we're on the AI, I've got a real gripe at the moment. It's become a bit of a curse. Is folks commenting on GitHub issues with just like ChatGPT generated nonsense?
Oh no!
And it's just like happening all the time. And it's like, really?
Does that? No.
And it's like, please don't do this. Please just, like, don't even bother posting that stuff. Like, yeah, if you want to use it as a research tool or whatever, but don't, like, there was one on, I don't know, Andrew Godwin's got this new API framework, and somebody asked a question, well, what's the difference between DRF and Ninja and Hatchway, it's called, I think.
Hatchway, sorry.
Hatchway. Yeah. And Andrew's like, well, I don't, and someone's just posted this thing about fast API, and it's like, but this is totally useless. Like, it's like a, and then again on Django, this has happened a number of times. We've had to block users, and it's just, oh, is this what the internet's becoming now? Ah,
sorry. You thought it was a dumpster fire already.
Yeah. And now. Yeah, it's already bad enough.
AI trained on a dumpster fire is like.
Yeah. And so I'm slightly.
There's bigger dumpster fires.
You know, I've played with these tools, and they're quite useful. You know, the Copilot is quite useful, particularly for writing tests. It's, you know.
Oh, yeah, the tech is fascinating.
It's lovely. But then if it just becomes yet another source of spam, another source of noise, it's already hard enough to find meaningful content and filter out the rubbish. And yet there's this other source of noise. So I'm a bit like, I'm having that frustrating this week. And you brought up the topic. Sorry, that's my little rant. I'll stop.
Well, there is a class action lawsuit about both Image and then also GitHub Copilot. Matthew Butterick is doing, because, you know, for example, like Django. Django's open source. And we have a software license. And you can type in things and get Django source code back to you that they're charging for, which,
yes.
I've had this argument with IP lawyer friends, and I'm like, if that's not an infringement, I don't know what is. But what is the DSF going to do? What, you know, even if they're wrong, they're Microsoft and they're going to win. So I think people don't understand Python. Even Python's tiny, you know, like Python can't go up against Microsoft in a lawsuit. So you know, in terms
plus,
of
the, you know, there's the whole conflict of interest thing there with, you know, Microsoft employing people like Hito.
Right. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see where it plays out. I'm glad there's some sort of class action just to sort of get at these legal questions which haven't been resolved, because it's, you know, not going to come from open source projects. They're not going to be able to pursue it.
Absolutely not.
I saw an interesting piece this morning. Probably Simon Wilson might have quoted it. That's not definitely, but that's probably where I saw it on his blog. But someone was comparing these kind of tools to like ChatGPT to like spell check. When you first started using spell check, I was like, no, you have to learn how to spell. But of course, it frees you up to just write without worrying too much about your spelling. And the argument being made in this piece was like, it's a good you know, starter to get some words down on the page, which clearly aren't perfect, but then the editing process and the refinement of it and the turning it into actual, you know, a text that's worthy of presenting is the creative work, where you might find the barrier of those first few words a blocker. And I don't know whether that's convincing or not, but it was an interesting take that I hadn't considered.
Well, it's also there's a take that it's, you know, autocomplete. You know, of course, it's not really autocomplete, but in the same way that, you know, we have autocomplete in Visual Studio Code and all these things, it's, but it's more than that because it is what it's trained on, right? So it's not just...
But it's kind of like, at the moment, it's like autocomplete that's been raiding Drew's homebrew. And it's kind of dangerously wrong in a number of cases.
Yes. Yes.
It'll be interesting. I mean, all this stuff is already... The question is, does it enhance people or replace people? So like, I just visiting... A friend of mine is a radiologist. Radiologists, pathologists, you know, these are doctors looking at images. They already... Everyone uses these tools that look at a scan and say, hey, the computer thinks you should look here, here, and here. And then a human, you know, confirms. But over time, you know, they probably won't get replaced because they have degrees and regulations. But there's so many other things that's like, ugh, you know, maybe.
And, I mean, those algorithms can be very flawed, too. Like, I mean, I saw one where they were looking at it for skin lesions and accidentally created a ruler detector because the images with rulers tended to be malignant, where the ones without tended to be benign.
Right. But in their case, all the, you know, so like PathAI, which is a sponsor of DjangoCon's, based in Boston, is one of these companies with pathology. They need the data sets. And, you know, so getting the data sets, getting, you know, however thousands, millions of approved things to train on, you know, they will get those eventually. And then once they do, then it's, you know, to me, it seems like there'll be places where there's regulation, like in medicine, where everyone will be happy because they charge the same amount. You know, they'll pay the fee because if a doctor can do 20 instead of 10 an hour for the same amount of money, that's a win. But there's all these other areas where if you can just get rid of the people, 90% is good enough. So, you know, like programmers, we don't have a union. So,
okay. I didn't think
ChatGPT, like, you know, okay. It's like you can have it create the Linux kernel, but like, can you have it create, you know, a good, you know, blog site with Django? Like, it could probably get part of the way there.
Well, I've been thinking, this is a bit philosophical now, this episode, folks, but...
Here we go.
I've been thinking about this a long time. Like, if you're a programmer, if to be replaced by a code creation tool, well, just go up a abstraction level and drive the code creation tool, program the code creation tool. Like, it's not... I don't really worry that computers are going to be generating all our software because there's so many design problems or so many... you know, usability problems or so many, you know, areas where a kind of human's creativity will always be able to be deployed that, you know, if they can write my DRF endpoints, well, fantastic, because I'm a bit bored of doing it, to exaggerate.
Yeah. That's the new job description, right? Have you seen this? There's a new job description, prompt engineer.
Right, okay, so what's that?
Have you seen this? No, have you seen this? This is a real thing. No, it's a real thing. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Drew, you've read about this as well?
I've seen it. It's basically where you know, your entire idea is to try and find the right prompt to make these ChatGPT type tools give you the output you want.
Right. Instead of your Google foo, it's your prompt foo.
Okay, but
your ChatGPT foo.
But you do need. But the thing is, you do.
There must
to your
be
point,
better tooling about, than just prompts, right?
Well, it's a funny name for this thing, but it does require. I mean, I think it's exactly to your point. You need someone who can craft a prompt, get an output, but then evaluate the prompt. And so that is going up a level of abstraction, but they still need to have the capacity to evaluate the output. It's not just trusting it, right? I mean, this is, I think, in a way, what you were saying. Yeah. So the question is, how do you train yourself to evaluate, you know, prompt responses, given that it's going to be bigger than maybe your, you know, where is that expert? It's like, okay, I'm focused on DRF endpoints, but now if I'm a prompt engineer, I can do all this stuff. How do I catch up to the point where I can adequately evaluate it because this the scope should be larger than if I'm handcrafting it myself. I don't know the answer, but...
I mean, the more Django example, right, is writing tests for your views to check that they work.
Yes.
Right? So you were discussing this on Mastodon the other day with Adam Johnson and Tim Schilling, you were discussing, like, you know, should we write, how do we write tests? Like, what kind of tests do you write? What coverage do you aim for?
Yeah, and there was someone else who wrote a lot of... forget their name, wrote some really nice feedback. But right. Yes, we were talking about that.
But the point being, I really think that you need a test on basically every view saying that it does a 200 when you're expecting a 200 and a 400 when you're expecting 400. And the reason why I like those tests is because they tell me when I broke something, that, you know, I left a I don't know, I left a colon somewhere in a model file such, and I didn't catch it. And I run the test suite and all my tests fail. And it's like, it's clearly that I've, you know, it just shows when something's radically wrong, even though those tests...
Yeah, it's a great smoke test.
Yeah, that test is never going to really fail. But I don't really enjoy writing those tests, so to speak. But I can write a class which will go through the URL conf and, you know, check, you know, write some standard tests for all of those. And then I can run that. And that's to go up an abstraction level. That's to do something a bit more that's not as labor intensive as, oh, did I do it for this endpoint? Did I do it for that endpoint? Did I do it for this endpoint? Which can get a bit boring, right? It can get a bit like, oh, I can't be bothered.
Well, that's what, this is the Jeff Triplett episode. That's what he says. He gets paid to write tests, not code, as a consultant, right? Because he gets parachuted into code bases and it's like, oh, I can't touch anything. So yeah, right.
It is. Well, do you have tests? And the answer is usually no.
Well, let's talk about tests, Drew. Let's get your take. Carlton and I bang on about this. I mean, my quick take is that tests are confusing, and then you kind of get how you do it, and then it's really monotonous, but you still need to do it. Like, what's your philosophy on tests, and then how, you know, at the Noun Project, how do you, you know, in the real world implement, you know, where these ideas of like 100% code coverage and stuff generally don't apply?
Yeah, well, I mean, for us to get 100% code coverage is realistically unattainable just because it is a massive sprawling code base. So, you know, we have to focus our energy based on where it has the most rewards, which is focusing on basically two levels. One, the business logic, like our code flows to make sure that people can buy icons, people can buy photos, people can subscribe, that those code flows work, you know, you handle the most common error case as well. So that way, when things break, they don't actually cause a 500 for the user. So, you know, check those things first and foremost. And then on top of that, just, you know, do a basic, quick and easy happy path and obvious error path check for the whatever API, GraphQL APIs you expose to the users. So that way, so that the client, at least if they're intentionally trying to break things, won't actually break things. So focus on breakage first. And then once you get a solid base in there, then you can work on speed, all the little polish around the edges type of thing.
Can I ask about, you talked about testing the flows, like for instance, the checkout flow, can I buy some icons? Do you use like Selenium or Playwright or something like that for that kind of site process?
Yes, actually, yeah. Our test engineer is actually right now on maternity leave. And she's written a massive automation suite in Playwright all those main flows and runs through all those flows on every time we're about to make a big deploy or anytime we're trying to, you know, make any sort of major functionality changes. She runs through all those and makes sure nothing broke and does a great job of staying on top of that and making sure that everything doesn't work like it does. So, you know, the tests I write are all focused within the Django unit test framework.
Yep.
And then we have the Playwright suite on top of that.
Yeah, I mean, the older I get, the more like casual mode for testing is like end-to-end testing. It's hard to write. It can be fragile because, you know, you move a selector and all of a sudden the test breaks. But they really do cover an awful lot of functionality with very few tests. And, you know, they're smoke for smoke tests. They tell you that something broke. It doesn't pin it to, oh, do you know what? It was this parameter to that function. But super helpful.
Yeah, I was going to say, in our front-end engineers, they use Jest, I believe it is, to do a bunch of internal testing within the React code base as well.
Okay, good.
I didn't hear you say PyTest, so do you just go, no PyTest?
Well, our Django code, the Django code base runs within the standard Django test runner, not within PyTest. And then our Flask code base uses PyTest.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I'll say this. I don't love PyTest. I know people do and like will die on that hill, but I feel like you can get a long way with just Django, just Django tests. But you know, it is the difference between smaller solo small team projects and larger projects.
I don't even think you go for that.
I'm trying to preempt.
I don't know if I agree with that.
All right. Well, anyways, I've used PyTest. Can be great, but I'm not completely sold on it. That's my controversial take of the episode.
Yeah. Right, I mean, Carlton? PyTest fixtures can be great if used right, but they're also a way to trip yourself over hardcore too.
It can be very confusing. Where did the fixture for this test come from? Whereas when you've got a unit test class where you've got the setup data at the top, and it might be slightly more repetitive, but okay, dry in your code, but repeat yourself in your test because you want to be able to open that test class and read the test class from top to bottom and know exactly what's going on. There's something important about that.
There's a lot of value to that.
You know, now
that's a bit of the function-based view, class-based views thing too, as well. There, I mean, it's just sort
don't
of...
get me started. God, you're gonna fall.
Hey, if we're gonna step into all these landmines, let's do them all at once.
What I really wanted to get to was, Carlton, why don't we just put everything in the urls.py file, right? Well, why do we need anything else?
Right, I'm gonna do a lightning talk at Gen Con. I'm gonna put everything in the urls.py.
Yep, that's like the dark magic that's like been out there, and I hear various corners. It's
I started Django a long time ago, and I used to put everything in logic in URL comps. And then some point, this line appeared in the docs where it said, "Oh, we don't really think you should put logic in the URLs.py file." I'd have to track it down. I'm sure it's still there. And every time I come across that, which every couple of years, I'm like, I don't agree with that. I think that's just wrong. And so, I've been sort of quietly keeping it to myself for a decade or so.
You're not the only one, though. I hear this whispered in the hallways at Django Cons.
Yeah, it's time for me to, you know, come out and be proud. Like, no, URLs.py for the win.
Well, where it comes out is, you know, is like, you know, how do you configure apps? And someone's like, I don't use apps at all.
We use lots of apps.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got, I'd say, probably about a dozen apps in there. Our URL conf is mostly pretty straightforward, nothing too fancy with it, except we have a couple things behind an if settings.debug check in there.
Yeah, okay.
But aside from that, pretty much everything else is straightforward, just a whole giant list of URL patterns.
Okay, so this is something Will and I have discussed a few times, is where if you get a new Django code base, where do you go first? And I always say the URLs are part. Will's often said the models. For you know, you can see the reason. Where if you get a new project or a new thing, what do you check out first to kind of get to learn that?
Yeah, first thing I check is to see actually the settings and see how do they have the structure. Yeah. Do they have the separate production versus local configuration? Do they have their code broken up into apps? How much are they trying to do from say environment variables versus reading from a settings file? You know, things like that. See what's their structure like there. Then work their way through the apps and go down that tree.
Okay, good. We both did
very aggressive nods when you said settings. Like, oh yes, that.
I saw that. Yes.
Well, again, can I ask Noun Project, what version of Django are you on? Like, how is all the work that the fellows are doing in the community, like in the real world, right? Because I know in the real world, companies are just almost always, you know, versions behind just because that's the business imperative. How does Noun Project stack up?
We are on 4.0. I have code written to port to 4.1 that works. It just, you know, the OpenGrady 4.1 just worked. The only reason we haven't deployed it yet is we're waiting for the test engineer to come back from maternity leave, so to give it a thorough tire kicking first.
That's fantastic. And what version of Python?
3.9. The reason we haven't gone any higher than that right now is because we use PyType for type checking, and that does not work very well on Python 3.10 yet. At least get the combination of our libraries we use plus that. There's some breakage involved that I haven't fully had time to digest yet. So maybe switching type checkers. I may be doing a whole bunch of digging, like excavation there. I'm not sure yet. That's just one of the things I need time for that.
And in your work, do you find that you have time to push fixes upstream? So you use a library that's perhaps not compatible with 3.10 and you got little leaks. Do you find that there's time in your week to make a patch and push it upstream?
If I need to, I can, although I haven't, fortunately, I have not run into that too much where, like, I think just recently we did an upgrade with cryptography that caused some slowdowns in our APIs, like trying to figure out what happened there and search through the issues. And then, oh, hey, there's one where someone saw the major performance regression and with exact fix or how to work around it. So, hey, it was well listed right in there and applied that fix and ta-da, we're back to normal. And actually got slightly faster as a result of that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, most of the time we're far enough behind the leading edge that doesn't necessarily affect us too much. But so I actually did submit a PR to Django way back when for trying to improve the MySQL inspect DB command. That kind of got lost in the shuffle. And I'm not sure where that is right now. I need to look back and figure out what that is.
Yeah, that happens sometimes. I can only ever apologize to people when they get sort of lost in the gap and it's like, oh, it needs a review. And
it happens.
You know, we've got quite a lot of
No, that's all right. It happens.
Coming in. I think that phrase
I cannot thank the work that you and Marius have been doing with maintaining the Django fellows and everything enough.
Oh well, thank you. I will say when you phrase you just used when you're far enough behind the leading edge, it's a good place to be where you sort of by the time you hit the issues, there's a workaround found and you can just roll along with it. It's like surfing
the wave is crested.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah, and then upgrading to 4.2, we probably can't do immediately because of the increase in MySQL minimum version. We're still on AWS Managed 5.7.
Yep.
So we need to upgrade to 8.0 before we can do that, before we can upgrade to Django 4.2.
Yeah, okay. Oh. This is where it's...
I mean, we're going to have to do that this year anyway, because MySQL 5.7 runs into support fairly soon anyway, so that's not like a major deal anyway. That's on our radar. We have to do it.
Yes, it's an interesting thing. Like, you've got real deployed code base. It's like we're looking at, well, which versions should we try and maintain, and which do we drop when? And it's, well, okay, this one now is reaching end of life. Okay, we can drop that.
And 4.2 being an LTS, it makes sense to not try and support a version of the database that's going to be going out of support very soon.
Exactly. I think this is Marish's take on that.
It's approved then. Deployment. How is... Wait, did you want to say something, Carlton?
No, carry on.
You're just excited about deployment.
Yeah,
I'm not
even
going to mention anything on your end. I'm just asking Drew this week.
Yeah, cool.
How is it how is it structured?
Okay, so deployment, we have it automatic build and deploy through AWS for our test and staging environments. And then we have the manual verification before we do a command line, just a simple command line script to deploy to production. It's just run through. It's just all done through AWS code build. It's fairly straightforward. And use Terraform for the actual infrastructure as such, defining the infrastructure.
That's all pretty cool, though. That's, you know, Terraform and code build and, you know, automate pipelines.
Yeah, fortunately, I don't have to manage much of that because Terraform syntax is absolutely Greek to me.
Yep.
But no, it's Joseph, when he was there, did a lot of this. And then Robert, and other back engineers, done a lot with it, too. So it's a pretty well set set there. So we don't have to worry too much about deployments going haywire. It's mostly just type deploy production and go, and then sit and wait 20 minutes while it does the roll in, roll out, sliding deploy.
Okay. And can I ask, is it like you've got a staging environment that you then promote to production, or does it redeploy again for that? That's just a...
It's a fresh deploy. The AWS builds the images separately on each environment.
Okay, cool.
Carlton, we have to mention that do you still read ancient Greek for fun at night?
Is that yes, it's still on my life project. I'm giving a keynote in PyCon Italia in May.
Yes,
so,
yes.
So I'm doing 3 months of Italian before I go. So current project is to pick up a bit of Italian. So I went to France recently.
Che bello!
Well, vale. I only started a couple of days ago. Give me a break. I went to France recently, and my French is now adequate. It's not great by any stretch.
Well, you're on like a 700-day Duolingo streak?
Yeah, something like that.
Right?
Yeah, nearly coming up for 700
days. I've seen something.
Days.
Excellent. Yeah, I've just gotten started.
No, carry on. It's brilliant. Literally, just a little bit.
Yeah, it is.
And I go to France. Yeah. I can speak French. It's like, well...
Which language, Drew, are you doing? French?
Spanish. Yeah, for me, I took Spanish through high school, and then I studied abroad in Madrid for summer of 06 through the Vodafone US Foundation. And so they paid for my scholarship in the wireless engineering program. And so that spent 6 weeks in Madrid doing some computation research and living in Madrid and being immersed in life. So it was great. And so actually my wife and I are going to Spain in July to celebrate our 15th wedding anniversary.
Fantastic.
And so, yeah, Carlton, I'll be talking to you about this as we get closer.
Well, if you're swinging near Barcelona way, let me know.
We fly into Barcelona, so yes, I will be talking to you about
that.
Okay,
let's get on the email after the show.
Totally. Yes. Yes. And so I basically fluent in back then. So I just picked up Duolingo again to try and, you know, refresh myself. And I'm at this weird point where like 99% of the stuff I know, and they do this, is like, oh, hey, I already know this. And then but it's like, okay, how do I get forward to the next level and keep going? So it's like, okay, just click through and test the next level, next level, next level, next level. And so I'm at that, I'm like the weird point where I know enough, but not quite the way they know it too. So it's like the different vocabulary, and also getting extremely frustrated the fact that Duo does not use vosotros, the formal you plural, at all. So it's like, why?
Oh, that's true, actually.
Hang on. I think there's a setting there. You can choose which Spanish you want to learn. You can either do sort of Central American Spanish where they don't use vosotros. So you could use the Castilian Spanish where they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh. Yes.
But anyway.
There's our prompt engineer.
Okay, Argentine Spanish where things are just weird.
Yeah, I don't know about Argentinian Spanish. I mean, Argentinian steak. No, that's a different topic.
Argentine uses mostly the same as Castellano with a slightly different... They use os as the you plural, as the tu pronoun instead of tu, but like instead of para ti, para os. It's very interesting. But they're... Yeah, this is a lot of fun because, I mean, when I was in Madrid, we had in our dorm, we had people from Argentina, Honduras, Croatia, Serbia, Germany, all over, and even a couple of people from the Basque Country, just all over the world. And it was a great little melting pot, getting to know different people from everywhere, made some good friends, and had a wonderful time there. So I'm looking forward to going back to Spain and seeing what I know.
No, I remember, I think we had a little chat in Spanish at DjangoCon. DjangoCon, US.
See, you're,
No, I remember you speaking Spanish quite well.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
Will, can I ask your question to Drew?
Yes.
Go on, Drew. So if there's, we're coming up on time, so we're sort of a rounding off type question, is if there's one magic wand and you could change one thing in Django, to what would that be? What, you know, if you could just have it?
I would have a case, have an API, have a blessed API, whether it be like a DRF, something in core.
Okay.
Because so many use cases these days have, you know, whether it be necessarily it's like serving something like HTMX or, you know, it can be format agnostic, so to speak, but just have a, this is the best way to rate your API in Django. Have something like that in core.
Well, best or just a default, a good anything. Enough, an 80.
an opinionated, this is the preferred way. Doesn't necessarily have to be the only way, but this is a, you're getting started, you're trying to write something and you don't know what you're doing. Use this to start until you would have a reason not to.
Okay, brilliant. Brilliant. I think that's a great answer because that's on my sort of long list of things that I'd like to get in as well. There's a work going on currently to add a request.data property that will not only give you form data if you submitted form data, but also if you submitted JSON, it would give you past JSON back, like kind of like DRF has done for many years. And then after that, we'd make that pluggable so you could provide your own parsers. You know, Django would probably only provide form data and JSON out of the box, but you know, you could. If you wanted message pack, you could have a parser.
But if you want to have a different format in there, you could do it, yeah.
And then the next question is serialization. So, you know, we've got forms, we've got the serializers for use for load data and dump data. That needs a refresh. There's Django serialization that's there as well. Then there's the modern things like Pydantic and Attas and Catas. And then, you know, there's projects like Django Readers where, you know, you define a spec and it creates exactly the select relateds and prefetch relateds and onlys and defers that you need to get just exactly the data you wanted and no more. It's a beautiful project. And so what can we do in this area? And so Andrews Hatchway is like his take on, you know, this first thing, and he's used Pydantic and mapped it into Django in what knows way. So it's like, okay, there's one. Let's do a couple of those. Let's look at, you know, what the options out there. How can we, because one option is let's just use Pydantic, right? It's great. But can we get some Django nicer so it ties into the ORM in, you know, the kind of way that, say, Django Readers is doing? We have an opportunity to take what's been learned in the last few years and, you know, really do something exciting. And that's not going to go straight into core, but some over the 5.x cycle, it would be really nice to have some stories there that, you know, that would answer your...
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Really exciting. It's kind of like the exciting what's left to do. You know, the last few releases have covered so many bases, and now it's like, okay, there's that.
I would agree. I think those are the two big ones, some sort of API serialization and then async. Though I did want to, maybe as my closing question thing out there, I had a reader was asking me about, I mentioned something about, I was like, oh, 4.2 has CycloPG3 support, and that's exciting. And he was like, I don't really understand. He's like, why are you excited about this? And I was like, well, async. And he's like, yeah, but why async? And I do think that the community and people who use Python and Django are convinced that async is the way to go. And we do need to have it. But 95, 99% of people are like, what? Like, you know, there's still like, if not a communication gap, you know, so I sort of worry in a way that it's almost like string theory. Like, it's beautiful and it kind of works, but like, is it core? I mean, I think it's hard to imagine it wouldn't be the way things are done in the future, but it's still a ways out. And so, you know, I realized, I was like, I don't have, you know, I was like, you know, here's the standard explanations for async, but I was also like, you don't have to use it. But, you know, for people who are into this kind of stuff, it is exciting and it will be, I think, important. But he was like, I read the docs and I don't know why I care.
No, I mean, for most, go on, I don't know.
No, please, I want to refer him to this.
For most use cases, don't use it. Like, you just don't, you know, your blog, I'm serving it with async views. Why? Just use your bog standard Django that you've been using forever and just keep going. It's much simpler. It's much less effort. But if you want real-time updates streaming out to a client or something like that, then there's a real case for async. Or if you want long-lived two-way communication, I don't know, like... The examples are like a chat client. But chat clients are a bit boring, but there's lots. No, but it's a nice example is that, you know, you're typing and you want to see a little notification that says you're typing. Well, that needs an open connection that's sending, you know, that little graphic. Is Drew typing? Yes, he is. Okay, well, okay, I'll wait for the response. That kind of instant update between the client and the server, that needs async. And then the other sort of end of the scale, but... You know, build your core app with sync and then tack on these little async bits that as they are needed. But really, it's not top priority. Then the other end of the scale is these high throughput servers that, you know, okay, you don't want to have to switch web framework or even language just because you have one of these use cases. So we need an async story for those high throughput cases. But even those are few and far between, really. There aren't many cases that need them. And then when you push it right to the limit, it really does become a question of why you're still using Python at all. Like, why aren't you using Rust or Go or whatever? And maybe Python can be competitive in those spaces for pure speed, but probably it can't. And then it's, you know, Django's going to get you close enough. But then by the time you're in that sort of super league, I don't know if it's worth Python's while competing. Maybe I'm wrong there. Maybe Python can compete for speed, but I'm not convinced. I'm not sure is more the point.
Well, and this is one of the issues with Python itself is that who's on the board of the PSF? It's, you know, Google, Microsoft, you know, it's companies that do have that interest at heart. And it is important that they push things forward, but that is the tension is you don't want to leave behind the beginner-friendly nature of Python itself because all the focus is on these more advanced use cases. I mean, I know that that's, you know, any language, that's an issue, is balancing that tension.
Yeah, it's where your priorities lie. And I see, you know, Microsoft, but they sort of, with the Azure, they started using Fast API, you know, and that's a big pickup for them. You know, is that the language I'd be using? I don't know. I just don't know. Is it Django?
Drew, is there anything you wanted to mention that we didn't ask you about or any chance to pitch?
A couple things. First of all, DjangoCon US 2023 sponsorships are open. If you're curious, email sponsors at DjangoCon.us. Catherine and Dawn, our sponsorship chairs, asked me to plug that on the show. And so also, we are currently giving away 2 tickets to the Python Web Conference that's happening it'll be this month by the time this airs, coming in March. The giveaway is on our Mastodon and Twitter. The forum's open until the March 2nd at 5 p.m. Eastern. So go ahead and, if you're listening in time, go ahead.
On the DjangoCon US Mastodon.
Yes, correct. That you can sign up there and you know, get a chance to win a ticket to the Python Web Conference. And also to tie back into when we were talking about tying in beer and Django, a quick plug for my little hobby project. It's called hsv.beer. What we do is we actually like survey the digital signage for like Untappd, Digital Pour, the various places that where breweries and tap rooms can list on the TV what's on tap and that shows up on their websites as well. And so we use Beautiful Soup to parse some of that and display it in a form that collates together everything in town that has that so they can see, oh, hey, I want this beer. Where is it on tap? And so you can find out without having to search through 6 or 8 different apps and venues to figure out, okay, I want this. Where do I get it? Or what's on tap at this local place? Is this anything I'm going to drink here if I'm picky or if it doesn't have much of a selection? And so it's a little fun thing that myself and 2 other people, here in town have done together to... try and make things easier for us. And it's just a little fun project using a DRF for the back end and Nux.js for the front end.
Nice. And that's at taplist.io, the site itself.
Is that actual website is literally hsv.beer. That's the domain.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Thank you for coming on. Wanted to have you on for a long time, both just to hear about your work, both professionally with Django Cons and just, you know, all these things that, you know, we got to chat about on the bikes.
Yes, definitely.
At 6 a.m. in San Diego. Mm-hmm. So
hopefully we can do that again in Durham this year.
We'll have to sort something out. I don't know Raleigh very well, Raleigh Durham, but
There is actually literally a mile, less than a mile from the hotel. There's what's called the Appalachian Tobacco. There's the American Tobacco Trail. That's a 14-mile rail trail. So convert a railroad into a paved trail that runs that literally go less than a mile out from the hotel, and it's there 14 miles of car-free riding.
Yeah, and also because it's a train line, it must be flat.
It's flat. Yeah, the rail trail means there's very little grade, very little side slope, wide turns, very easy riding.
Yeah. Okay. Great. All right. Well, we have time. We'll sort out some company to rent bikes from and get a little group.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you, Carlton. Thank you, Drew. We are JangoChat.com. We are on Mastodon. And check out the links for the call for proposals and if you want to help out with DjangoCon as well. See everyone next time.
Join us next time. Bye-bye.